A blowfire to provide for the management and control of some trees. The animal will need for the environment, energy, climate change, and education.
I have a note here that a blowfire to provide for the management and control of some trees is read for the first time.
No, Peter question, which is that a blowfire to provide for the management and control of some trees is read for the first time. Those in favor? Those against, carried.
The Senate is at 2019.
The Speaker has a number to move that the bill will be now read a second time. The Speaker, the current Senate Act was commenced in 1889 and needless to say it required review. The purpose of this bill is to revise and modernize legislation pertaining to Senate. To this end, subsidiary legislation accompanying the existing Senate Act will be revoked, and new subsidiary legislation, the Senate's Regulation 2018, will be put in place. These regulations will be introduced when the Senate's Act 2018 is commenced. The existing Senate Act only applies to the Senate at North Front and does not extend further. This has been rectified in the bill and is now applies to all cemeteries within the control of the government of the Delta. The cemeteries bill amends the manner in which the North Front Cemetery Court is managed and now follows some of the main changes. Although the post of superintendent remains, this is shortly, as it is intended that this post will eventually disappear. Instead, the functions previously or currently exercised by the superintendent will be carried out by the cemetery authority in conjunction with the cemetery keeper. The post of superintendent will be determined by notice in writing by the cemetery authority. The cemetery authority will be established, which will be responsible for the general management and supervision of the cemetery and registration and control of burials. It will act in accordance with the policies of the government. To this end, the cemetery authority will do all things it considers necessary or desirable for the proper management, regulation, and control of the cemetery. As provided for in the bill, the cemetery authority may delegate any of its powers to a cemetery keeper. The post of keeper will continue in the new bill, so that the keeper will not be under the direction of the authority. More than one cemetery keeper may be appointed by the minister by notice in the Gazette. The Board of Visitors established under the current Cemetery Act remains so that it is now known as the Cemetery Board and it advises the Cemetery Authority on matters concerning its powers, functions, and responsibilities under the Act and brings to the attention of the Cemetery Keeper any matters relating to the upkeep of the cemetery. In regard to the definition of burial, that definition was absent in the existing Cemetery Act. For the sake of clarity, it has now been defined in the new Act to include a human body or remains, cremated remains, or the bodies of stillborn children, or cremated remains thereof. Given the development in legislation since the existing Cemetery Act was drafted in the late 1800s, and specifically in light of the Crematoria Act 2008, it was appropriate to include cremated remains in the definition. The definition of burial rights has been revised and it's clearly stated within the body of the Act that burial rights do not afford any legal or equitable right to a plot of land. Instead, the Act provides that a burial right grants a person the exclusive right to burial on a plot of land, subject to such terms and conditions as may be prescribed by the cemetery authority. On the question of registration of burials in the register, Mr. Speaker, the procedure for the registration of burials has also been modified, making it a requirement that specific information be entered into the register as soon as reasonably practical after each burial. The register will be maintained by the cemetery authority and may only be altered with the consent of the authority. Additionally, an electronic copy of the register will be compiled by the authority and is to be forwarded annually to the Gibraltar Government Archives. This is a new provision in the bill. The new legal alterations remain the same, so that this time I lie with the authority as opposed to the superintendent. This also applies to powers pertaining to the maintenance of good order and appearance in the cemetery. Offences in the cemetery are not taken lightly and will need a simple review, particularly the level of fines which has now been increased. We would see the fine for any person who made any, quote, noise or disturbance or, quote, was guilty of any disorderly conduct in the cemetery was liable and family conviction to a fine of £5. This has now been increased to a fine not exceeding level 3 in the standard rate, that is a £1,000 fine. Furthermore, offences in the cemetery have also been reconsidered and will now range from willfully creating a disturbance in the cemetery, committing a nuisance in the cemetery, willfully interfering with any burial taking place in the cemetery, playing any game of sport, and remaining in the cemetery after it is closed to the public. Speaker, this bill is essential in modernising Gibraltar's legislation. The offences are not 129 years old and clearly out of date. It will ensure better and more effective management of the cemetery and cemeteries, and together with recent improvements in the landscape maintenance, will provide more dignity to the cemetery and to those who this community lays to rest. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the principles and merits of this bill?
The Honourable Trevor Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And thank you, Minister, for that explanation of the bill, which we will, on this other hand, keep supporting. It is an important update to the existing legislation, as the Minister pointed out, so it dates back to the 1800s. So there is only one point that I would just ask a little bit of clarification, and that is in the establishment of the authority itself. How or who or what body does the minister envision to play in that particular role, because clearly it's quite an important role. In terms of the legislation, the cemetery, or as the bill or the act when it's passed, makes clear it will be cemeteries that are covered by this, are all obviously very important to our community. They frequently feature in local press where people are concerned. Reference them to this, and I'm sure this effort has to go some way to ensuring that the focus is maintained on the condition of our cemeteries and that they are looked after in an appropriate manner, bearing in mind that there is no importance to our community. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Honourable member, wish to speak on the bill? The Honourable Namura?
Mr. Speaker, yes, in order to clarify that, at this point in time, the duties of the cemetery authority is intended, at least in the short term, to be carried out by the Department of the Environment, which is the authority that currently manages the cemetery. This may not continue in the longer term, and I'm looking forward to having discussions with the new cemetery board as to whether they feel that there should be some different mechanism. But at this point in time, it will be the Department of the Environment that will be the cemetery authority. I welcome the support of the members' offices, and I obviously look forward to commencing this once passed and to updating the cemetery rules, which will be published at the time of commencement.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for the management and control of cemeteries be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Cemeteries Act 2003.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee's third and third reading of the bill we're talking today is all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree with the committee's third and third reading of the bill we're talking today.
The bill for an act to amend the Nature Protection Act 1991, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Nature Protection Act 1991 be read a third time.
And I'll put the question, which is that a bill for an act coming to the Nature Protection Act 1991 be heard the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Nature Protection Amendment Act 2018.
Is it I have learned to know that the bill now be read for a second time. Mr. Speaker, the Nature Protection Act was published in 1991. It is now 27 years old. This is a long period in which changes will arise in scientific thinking and the status of plant populations. The changes to the Act take these points into account. Taxonomy, the classification of organisms, is always in a state of flux. This is normal. Improvement in scientific methods inevitably lead to our fine-tuning of knowledge of relationships between species. The past decades have especially been important in this respect, as advances in molecular analyses, which unravel past patterns in DNA, have produced many new arrangements of plant classification, including quite a number of surprises. The updated studies reflect this latest knowledge in nomenclature. Another point is the changes of populations of organisms undergo over time. These take place constantly, but at an accelerated rate in our rapidly changing world. Thus, some species in Gibraltar are comparatively more rare and more than 27 years ago, and vice versa. These changes have been taken into account when upgrading or downgrading species protected statuses. So far, have any improvements in our knowledge of species populations and dynamics over the past 3 decades. Finally, Nature Protection Act Schedule 2 reverse list, so that species that are not listed are automatically protected. The current changes provide more robust measures to ensure that only new species that are colonizable or naturally are protected, without providing protection to exotic invasive species or garden plants in the sense that it will not be legal to deadhead rank pelargonium. The proposed changes will all result in an even more sensible and practical act, affording added protection to our special and important flora, and I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, as an honourable member, I wish to speak on the general principles and norms of the bill, the Honourable Sarah Hammond. Mr. Speaker, may I say the Minister's enthusiasm for this particular bill is very clear to see. And those of us on this side of the House will be supporting these amendments there. It is obviously necessary to amend the bill from time to time, and amend it from time to time. It is a regular thing. So yes, we will be supporting the bill. I now put the question that the bill. Will the bill for an act to amend the Nature Protection Act 1991 be read a second time? Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Honourable Minister in Committee.
And Mr. Speaker, I basically notice that the committee's first and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do I remember the please of the committee's first and third reading be taken today?
A bill for an act to establish the office of Director of Public Prosecution under the direction of the Attorney General and for matters committed thereto. The Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to establish the Office of Director of Public Prosecution under the direction of the Attorney General and for matters connected thereto be read a first time.
Now, I put the question, which is that a bill for an act to establish the Office of Director of Public Prosecution under the direction of the Attorney General and for matters connected thereto be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Director of the Public Prosecution Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, in accordance with one of the government's manifesto commitments, the bill establishes the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution. Currently, as a result of the position in our legislation, the day-to-day work of the DCP in Gibraltar has been carried out by the Attorney General. This arrangement is distinct to that in different parts of the United Kingdom, where the DPP, or the local equivalent, and the Attorney General, or the local equivalent, are two separate entities. Consequently, government was committed to making the necessary changes so that our system would replicate that in the United Kingdom, and in particular, that in England as well. The payment of the DPP is set out at clause 4 of the bill. Previously, the bill provided that such appointment would be done by the government in consultation with the AG. However, after further discussions with the Attorney General, and in order to be absolutely certain that there is no question of the independence of the post, I will be moving amendments at committee stage so that the appointment is made instead by the Attorney General after consultation with the government. Furthermore, the person appointed must not only have relevant experience and expertise in criminal law and litigation, but also be a fit and proper person. I shall also be amending this clause to set out further the qualifications for DPP must hold. In line with the amendments mentioned above, the AG, after consultation with the Governor, also retains the power to suspend and ultimately remove such person from office for misbehaviour, neglect of duty, material breach of contract, of employment or instrument of appointment, incapacity, incompetence or bankruptcy. As regards the appointment, once the person's appointment to hold office as DPP has expired, he may be eligible for the appointment, provided he has not resigned beforehand or been removed from office by the AG, again, after consultation with the Governor. The main changes resulting from the term, Mr. Speaker, are as follows, namely, the DPP shall take the Office of Criminal Prosecution and Litigation, akin to the that performed by the Crown Prosecution Service in England and Wales. He will seek to carry out such functions and exercise such powers as conferred upon him or her under general special instructions issued by the AG in accordance with Section 59, Subsection 3 of the Gibraltar Constitution Order 2006, and on a day-to-day basis carry out criminal law and litigation work on behalf of the AG, and may do anything which appears to him or her to be incidental or conducive to the carrying out of the duty. However, the DPP will not be able to act in any manner contrary to any instructions given to him or her by the AG, or be able to act in cases where the AG has personally exercised a power or discretion. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Speaker, I wish to note that the Honourable Mr. Beaton called me to discuss the bill. I was happy to note that his concerns have been addressed by my letter to Mr. Speaker on the 14th of June of this year. I am therefore, Mr. Speaker, pleased to note to count on the support of the Honourable Members opposite. All the reasons Mr. Speaker to commend the bill to the House.
All right, to the question of the Honourable Member, we should speak on the general principles and merits of the bill. The Honourable Diana Beacham.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, yes. As the Honourable Minister has said during the course of his address, the opposition is going to be supporting this bill. Mr. Speaker, we had great doubts about the bill as originally drafted, which we felt could potentially be unconstitutional in terms of the appointment of the way that the Director of Public Prosecution was going to be appointed, but those have been dealt with by the amendments that the Honourable Minister is going to be moving, and therefore our support is for the bill as amended. Mr. Speaker, just a little bit in relation to that, before I come and say a few words about the post itself and how, in particular, this is a post that has also been adopted in other overseas territories. Mr. Speaker, the consulate of Her Majesty's Attorney General for Gibraltar is a post that's recognised in the Constitution. And it's protected in three ways. It's protected because the Attorney General of Gibraltar has got to be appointed by the government on advice of a specified appointment committee. It's a specified appointment committee that effectively undertakes the process, interviews candidates, and then will advise the governor on the most appropriate candidates. And it's designed to ensure that the process is, of course, independent, in particular of the government, which is not unusual in most jurisdictions where the Attorney General is not a political appointment. Remember that in the United Kingdom, for many years, the Attorney General was a political opponent. And I'll come back to that in relation to Bermuda in a moment. It also speaks, the Constitution also speaks to give the Attorney General security of tenure by preventing the removal of an Attorney General except in very specified circumstances which have now been clarified by the Supreme Court in the decision involving the former Chief Justice in 2009. And it also protects certain functions of the Attorney General. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Just be longer with the Chief Minister wanted to give way. Sorry, I beg your pardon. And it also seeks to protect certain functions of the Attorney General, which are the functions of our prosecutorial functions. That's in contrast with some other overseas territories, where not only are prosecutorial functions also protected by the Constitution, but advising functions. For Gibraltar is just a prosecutorial function. And those functions are functions that can only be delegated by Her Majesty's Attorney General for Gibraltar. That is why when the bill said that the appointment of the Director of Public Prosecution was going to be the government, or the person that made the appointment was going to be the government on advice of the Attorney General, we felt that in this side of the house we couldn't support it because potentially it would file for Section 59 of the Constitution. That is no longer the position as a consequence of these amendments. But, Mr. Speaker, I think that this is a matter that, in due course, will have to be dealt with by any constitutional conference that's convened between the Gibraltar side and the UK side, because I think that it is important that the role of Director of Public Prosecution also be enshrined in the Constitution. Until very recently, in fact, and I talk about very recently, the last 10 to 15 years, the only overseas territory constitution that provided for a Director of Public Prosecution was Bermuda. And honourable members may recall, in fact, I think it was Dr. Garcia from in this parliament, I think it's only Dr. Garcia that was a member of the Select Committee on Parliamentary Reform. The present today, was only Dr. Garcia. Dr. Garcia will recall that the draft constitution that was presented to the United Kingdom as a start of a negotiation for a new constitution with the United Kingdom, I think it was the draft constitution was completed in 2001, it was presented to the UK in about 2002, 2006, correct me if I'm wrong in relation to my dates. But that copied the Bermuda constitution in terms of Director of Public Prosecution, which is that if there is in Bermuda somebody that from the Parliament in Bermuda that is a legal practitioner that's appointed as Attorney General, then the role of Director of Public Prosecution is exercised by somebody else. That's designed to keep both roles separate. And in the course of those negotiations, we were told by the negotiators, the UK negotiating side, that that was something that wouldn't happen ever again in any other constitution that the UK agreed to. That's specific, and that's why it's not included in our constitution. Otherwise, we would have had a situation where, for example, the Honourable Mr. Costa could have performed the role of Attorney General under the constitution that we proposed, and then the Director of Public Prosecution role would have been somebody else, which would have been independent of the government. And therefore, even in 1999, 2000, 2001, it was envisaged by the Select Committee then that it was possible that the appointment of, or the creation of a post of Director of Public Prosecution was something that would have been beneficial for Gibraltar, albeit in those circumstances. Now, since we negotiated a constitution with the United Kingdom, there have been several other new constitutions, and in fact, the Cayman Islands, Montserrat, the British Virgin Islands, they've all decided that they would also have a director of public prosecution, but that would be enshrined in their constitution to make sure that the director of public prosecution is independent in appointment, in tenure, and in relation to its functions as I have. And I'm going to read to this out a passage from a textbook which is very good on digital privacy policy. It's called Digital Privacy Overseas Policy Law. It's by Ian Henry and Stephen Dickinson. The edition that I have is 2011, and one of my honourable friends, the leader of the opposition, says that there's been an edition that's been published this year. And it basically says this, and I quote, "In the Cayman Islands, Montserrat and British Virgin Islands, the Director of Public Prosecutions is appointed in the same way, has the same security of tenure, and enjoys the same constitutional protection for his or her pension as the Attorney General. In Bermuda, the Governor appoints the Director of Public Prosecutions, and his or her discretion may only remove the Director for inability or misbehavior and on advice of an independent tribunal, and there is a constitutional protection for the Director's remuneration and pension. These various provisions provide a high degree of constitutional independence for the directors of public prosecutions in these territories, the importance of which cannot be overstated," end quote. And I think that is an important quotation, and I think that when the time comes for us to review our existing constitution, this should be one of the issues that should be at the top of our list of priorities, to make sure that the independence of the Director of Public Prosecution is enshrined in our constitution. I'm told by the leader of the opposition in the UK, the Attorney General is still a political appointment. I don't know how far that takes the debate. If that is the impression that I've caused in Parliament, I apologise. I wasn't 100% certain whether the position in the UK about the Attorney General being a political appointment continued even today. And even if it was very recently a government minister was also the Attorney General, but I wasn't 100% certain. It wasn't my intention to create the impression that that had changed in the UK. But in any event, my learned friend has asked me to clarify the position I have to
do. I'm the Honourable member. We can continue to the debate on the second reading of the bill. I'll ask them over to reply. Honourable Neil Costa.
Well, Mr. Speaker, to take the Honourable Government's point, taking in turn, in respect of whether the Constitution should be enshrined in the Constitution, in the same way that the Constitution is enshrined in the Constitution in Section 59, it certainly is not a matter for us here today. It would be a matter for the Committee of the South should this point arise where there should be a further negotiation to further develop the Constitution. Although, without wishing to be political, I dare say that the GSD would tell us that there would be no need, because as far as they were concerned, it would be the national level of government. So it's surprising to hear the Honourable Gentleman say that there may be a need to progress the Constitution, and indeed the need may arise in the future. But if I take the Honourable Gentleman to Section 59, Section 2, it says that the Attorney General, by the power in any case, when he considers it desirable to do so, to institute and undertake criminal proceedings into any court of law, and then Section 59 to Section 3, the powers of the Attorney General under Section 2 may be exercised by him in person or through other persons acting in accordance with the general or special instructions. So, therefore, the bill, what it does, is provide a formal framework for the OG to be able to delegate that part of his responsibilities as are set out in the Constitution of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, the reality is that the creation of the DCP was as a result of various, I thought, detailed discussions, because, of course, no one here is going to suggest that any Crown Council or any person previously carrying out the functions in effect of the DCP is anything other than entirely removed and entirely independent from the government. So that the voter has not required the place of the DCP to be enshrined in statute for there to ever be any question whatsoever of anybody describing the functions of a Crown Council to have been anything other than entirely independent from the executive branch of government. And to give the gentleman comfort in the issues that he raises, he will have noticed that at the very end of the bill, and as part of the changes that I propose to move at the committee stage, at clause 6, it says the government, made by regulation, makes such modifications or adaptations or any enactments except for this act. And of course, the good without saying that the lawyers in the House will know that you cannot amend our primary piece of legislation other than by coming to the side of the bill. That it is in order to provide no doubt whatsoever that the content of this bill will not be able to any amendment to the legislation that we insisted that the word save this act be included at clause 6. I wish to address the point that the honourable member has made. I hope that I've been able to address the questions.
I'll now put a question. If you've got a bill for an act to establish the Office of Director of Public Prosecutions under the direction of the Attorney General, and for matters connected thereto, be heard a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Director of Public Prosecutions Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to various certain provisions contained in the will of the late John McIntosh, the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to very certain provisions contained in the will of the late John McIntosh be read the first time.
And I put the question, which is that a bill for an act to very certain provisions contained in the will of the late John McIntosh be read the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The John McIntosh Will, Variation of Trust Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill varies clause 22B of the will of the late John McIntosh, dated the 6th of March 1938. Clause 22B of the will states that the trust fund is to be used for educational purposes for the benefit of children whose parents are resident in Gibraltar, and in particular, for the purpose of promoting the teaching in Gibraltar of the English language and of English history and literature, and generally promote and strengthen, so far as practicable, by educational means, the ties between England and Gibraltar. The trust property included a piece of land on which a public hall known as the John Master Hall was erected. The property is left to the Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar and is used for a wide variety of purposes, not limited to educational purposes. As we all know, the John McIntosh Hall is one of our main cultural centres and is used for a wide variety of purposes, including conferences, lectures, as well as musical performance and for general elections. As a result, the questions of the McIntosh Hall applied to the Supreme Court to seek to widen the use clause of the premises of the John McIntosh Hall. In this regard, the site-wide application was made to amend the terms of the trust declared by the will to enable the terms of a lease to cover the uses of which the hall was being used. However, the application was refused, and in a judgment on the 8th of December 2015, the judge noted that a better course of action was to legislate specifically to allow the amendment of a similar fashion to such which occurred in 1967. In 1967, the clause 22b of the will was subject to as a variation by an Act of Parliament whereby the terms of the will were widened in order to expand the definition of schools in England to include universities, colleges of higher education, or similar institutions. Mr. Speaker, this bill seeks to vary the terms of the John Magnus will so that the trustees of the trust fund shall have the power and shall be deemed to have always had the power to maintain the John Magnus will and to use and or allow the use of the hall for the following purposes. A cultural development of Gibraltar, including lectures, theatrical activities, concerts, and plays, and B, generally for the benefit of the public in Gibraltar, including for professional and trade meetings, political activities such as rallies, meetings, and general elections, whether in the English language or otherwise. Mr. Speaker, I therefore commend this bill to this House.
Before I put a question, as an honourable member wishes to speak on the principles and merits of this bill, the honourable leader of the opposition.
I'm grateful to the honourable minister for setting out the background to the bill, particularly in relation to the judgment of the then Mr. Justice Jack. Just one point of clarification in relation to I think it's paragraph 38 and 39 of the learned judge's judgment, where the judge talks about the alternatives between passing an act in this house and also dealing with this by way of a trustee simply renting the matter to the government. You know, the suggestion by the judge in court was either the government the trustee could rent the hall to the government, which is what the honourable minister alluded to in respect of what happened in the past. Or alternatively, not as the honourable member said, the better course of action, the alternative was for this house to pass an act to vary the will accordingly. Now, of course, we support the government's position on that, but we just wanted to clarify the position that the purpose of this is to expand the use of its non-educational purposes. But the two points raised by the judge in his judgment were those two that I've explained. So one is that it was an alternative, not a better use, better way of dealing with it, but an alternative way of dealing with it. It would be helpful if the minister could just clarify his remarks in respect to those two points.
I'm grateful that the honourable member is going to vote in favour of this bill, and I think his point where it could be, as Peter probably said, that there are two alternatives as opposed to one. We have taken this course of action. We believe that this is the best course of action to have taken, and therefore that's why I'm presenting this bill to the House. Yes, I think the point about the judgment. So therefore, I commend the bill to the House. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to vary certain provisions contained in the will of the late John McIntosh be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The John McIntosh will variation of trust act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of a bill be taken today is all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today.
The bill for an act to revise the law governing planning and development council committee purposes. The honourable minister for infrastructure and planning.
I have learned to move that a bill for an act to revise the law governing planning and development and for council purposes be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to revise the law governing planning and development of connected purposes before the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Town Planning Act 2018.
Is our best move of the bill for Town Planning Act 2018 be read a second time. The purpose of a new bill is to revise, modernize, and strengthen the law in town planning. Under the existing Town Planning Act 1999, the procedure for planning application and notification of a planning application was unclear and inadequate. The Department of Town Planning would often find itself in receipt of planning applications without supporting documents. This had a twofold effect. Firstly, the department would invariably have to chase applicants for outstanding documentation on various occasions. This was time-consuming, frustrating, and an inefficient use of staff resources. Secondly, because the department did not hold a complete set of documents pertaining to the application, this meant that members of the public were unable to inspect and the complete application at the offices of the department within the allowed time frame and make an objection if they so wish. The new Town Planning Bill 2018 has brought about a number of changes to rectify and address these concerns and other matters raised by industry-related professionals conversant with the Town Planning Act 1999 who wanted to improve the current regime. I shall now highlight these changes. The term permit in the Town Planning Act 1999 has been revised. Previously, under the Town Planning Act 1999, applications for planning fell into two categories, outline planning permission and permit. Under the new bill, applications for planning permission now fall into outline planning permission and full planning permission. Collectively, their back terms are referred to as planning permission. The reason they have been revised is to align them more closely with the wider of the terminology used in the town planning profession. It is hoped that this will also reduce confusion and that sometimes arose with applicants who often have to obtain additional permits from other statutory bodies. Outline planning permission is defined in the bill as an in-principle decision to grant planning permission. It must be stressed that this does not allow the carrying out of development per se. This can only happen once full planning permission has been obtained. The advantage of keeping outline planning permission in the drafting is that it allows an applicant to learn within the early stages of the proposed development before incurring great expense whether his application will have a strong likelihood of success. We wanted to keep this in the new act. The speed of the second category planning permission falls into is full planning permission. Full planning permission, previously referred to as a permit in the current Town Planning Act 1999, gives permission to develop in accordance with the terms of the permission and provisions of the bill. We see that the new bill clarifies the procedure involved for making an application for planning permission. If a development does not fall within a class of development designated by regulations, the applicant has to follow the procedure set out in Clause 22. If, however, the development does fall within a class of development designated by regulations, the applicant has to, in addition to the procedure laid out in Clause 22, adhere to the provisions set out in Clause 22. Under Clause 22, the application and all the supporting documents are submitted to the town planner, who then validates the application. The date of validation is crucial in this procedure, as only when the application is validated by the town planner will 21 working days start to run for members of the public to make representations on the application. This gives objectors the opportunity to make representations within the aforementioned 21 working days. This new provision, which is absent in the current Town Planning Act 1999, is an important amendment to the procedure on application for planning permission. Not only will it give objectors the opportunity to make representations within a stipulated time frame, as mentioned above, but this emphasis on 21 working days will address situations where public participation period falls over a holiday period, for example, Christmas, which in the past had the effect of limiting the opportunity for the public to view and comment on the application at hand. In the speaker shows you, another change in procedure is that we now require publication in the Gazette and two newspapers in Gibraltar. Previously, a daily and a weekly newspaper was specified.
Consider the new campaign bill allows an application for planning permission to be made online by the applicant. Furthermore, the bill makes it a requirement for the Development and Planning Commission to publish all applications received by them electronically. It is worthy of mention that this has been done since the e-planning portal was introduced. This further enhances transparency of the planning process. So too, the Development and Planning Commission's decision will be published and made available online. Collectively, these provisions will greatly enhance the public access to information on applications that may affect them and will ensure at least a minimum period for public participation. The Speaker, the definition of development has been revised. Clarification is provided that development includes inter alia operations such as the enclosure of a balcony or veranda, removal, replacement or installation of shutters, removal, replacement or other alterations of any window, and the replacement of existing roof coverings. It must be mentioned, though, that where said replacement of windows and shutters does not materially affect the external appearance of the building and is on a like-for-like basis using the same materials, that it does not constitute development. In these circumstances, approval needs to be sought under the Building Rules 2017. This is important to emphasize and clarify for the avoidance of doubt that most building works will require planning permission under town planning legislation as well as approval under the Building Rules 2017. However, building works that do not constitute development under town planning legislation and consequently do not require planning permission shall nonetheless still be subject to building rules and require approval from the Building Control Department. Additionally, the definition of development has been further amended to exclude work to the interior of a building from the definition. Therefore, works of this nature do not require planning permission, although, as mentioned above, may still require building control approval under the Building Control Rules 2017. It must be noted, though, that patios, courtyards, and other similar spaces are considered to form part of the external appearance of a building. That will fall within the definition of development and require planning permission. Mr. Speaker, government projects are now subject to the planning process under the provisions set out in the town planning bill. Consequently, certain classes of development as designated by regulations will be subject to public participation and will require a site notice and publication online. It must be said that although currently government applications have no public participation requirement under the Town Planning Act 1991, government has been submitting applications voluntarily to the DPC for its advice and guidance. This is in contrast to the current Town Planning Act 1991, the new Act makes it a requirement, as contained in 31, that meetings of the Commission relating to planning applications are to be held in public. That is certain exceptions, that is in the interest of security of the voter. This also applies to development appeals tribunal meetings. Mr. Speaker, it is also worthy of mention that anybody who makes a representation on an application shall be given an opportunity of being heard by a development and planning commission at a meeting. This provision was absent in the current Town Planning Act 1999. Mr. Speaker, under the new Town Planning Bill, the enforcement procedure, known as enforcement orders in the current Town Planning Act 1999, has been modified to enable the DPC to issue an enforcement notice where a breach of planning control has taken place. Failure to comply with said enforcement notice constitutes an offence. This differs from the arrangement under the current Town Planning Act 1999, where a DPC has to first criminally convict a person in court before enforcement proceedings to be commenced. Mr. Speaker, it is hoped that this change will assist in the speedy enforcement of planning control on the use of need to go to lengthy and costly court proceedings, except of course where the person refuses to comply with the requirements of an enforcement notice. Additionally, the new Town Planning Bill now allows DPC to take legal action and commence proceedings for an offence 12 months in a date by the commission of the offence or the matter complained of, which is covered. This differs from the previous stance under the Town Planning Act 1999, where cases were required to be brought to court within 6 months, and also further highlights that time starts to run from discovery of the offence and not from the date it actually occurred. The Speaker, appeals against enforcement notices were also absent in the current Town Planning Act 1999, and this has now been catered for.
Equally, the penalty for being found in breach of an enforcement notice has now been increased to a fine at level 5 on the standard scale and to a daily fine at level 3 on the standard scale for each day the terms of a notice are not complied with. The level of fines in the new Act has also been increased in relation to specific orders and general offences. The Speaker, the Council on Foreign Acts 1999 gave the Commission the power to modify planning permissions. It did not cater to situations when applicants went to make minor amendments to planning permissions after it was granted. However, we have now cater to this and the bill allows an applicant to make an application to the Commission for a minor amendment to a previously granted planning permission. This provision gives the Commission the power to accept these minor changes provided that they are within the parameters stipulated therein. It also allows the Commission, if it considers appropriate, the right to require an applicant to serve notice of the minor amendment on certain individuals and allows them an opportunity to make representations. Along the same lines, but in this case, before planning permission has been granted by DPC, the new bill also gives an applicant the power to modify his application, providing permission of sought and obtained from DPC for such modifications beforehand. If this power is indeed exercised by the applicant, the DPC may only file that said modification sought as subject to the public participation process. Mr. Speaker, in addition to the requirements for notification, the Commission may require applicants for planning permission to bring the application to the attention of specified individuals. The majority of people within the vicinity of the land to which the application relates are thus made aware of the application. Mr. Speaker, finally, the new Town Planning Act provides a regulation-making power to regulate the painting of the external facade of any building and also provides a right of appeal to a tribunal from a decision by the Commission on advertisement applications. This was absent and not taken for in the current Town Planning Act 1999. I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any Honourable Member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? The Honourable Trevor Hammond. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a very welcome bill, as I said, the Minister, that this part of the House will be supporting the bill. It is, of course, the element that was originally in 2011 when we did the manifesto. Obviously, they weren't delivered during that period, but they are now being delivered, so they are welcome in that respect. It is a shame that the bill wasn't presented earlier and 7 years have passed, because obviously a number of projects, some of which may be considered controversial by some, have been put through by government, which may otherwise have been received more challenge through the DPC process, because, for instance, of the current blocks in the first few which are not necessarily the most popular, many other things in college. But, nevertheless, I don't want to make this very political argument, to be honest with you. It is a welcome piece of legislation. And coming to the legislation itself, I wonder if the Minister would consider or clarify why perhaps some of these points haven't been considered as part of the bill, or that they may be incorporated going forward. In terms of the appeals process, which I know in this bill is a copy-paste, effectively, of what was previously there, as I said, the previous legislation allowed only planning applicants to appeal decisions to the DPC, which seems to load the process somewhat in favour of the applicants, and I thought perhaps that is something that we still might have addressed, and I do regret not bringing it to the Minister's attention sooner, but would ask government whether they would consider introducing such amendments to allow objectors to appeal to planning decisions and thereby redress that current imbalance. The nearest and arguably most important part of the legislation is that requiring government projects to be subjected to the planning process, a change which we on this side of the rail say wholeheartedly welcomed. There is a caveat in that particular part of the legislation for urgent cases, and I would ask the Minister to explain further how this clause might be invoked and in what circumstances, in other words, what might be considered urgent, because it would be unfortunate if such a clause were to be used as a matter of convenience by the political expediency. And I'm sure this is not the intention, but clarification would be welcome. And Mr. Speaker, another question that arises from this section of the bill is whether ministers will continue to sit on DPC when it is considering government projects.
there'd be a very clear conflict of interest in such cases. And I would again ask the Minister if such has been considered and would provision be made when these circumstances inevitably arise to deal with such conflicts by excluding ministers or having ministers recuse themselves, as perhaps would be the case for other members of the committee, should an application be received from them specifically. The next step, of course, might be to remove ministers entirely from the DPC, and then for that assessment of any subject to further debate and further discussion, possibly at future general elections. But doing so would clearly increase the independence of that particular body, the DPC, from the executive. Mr. Speaker, I say again, we will be supporting this bill. Honourable member, would you speak on this bill? Honourable Chief Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I wanted to highlight the similar importance of this bill, which is one that, in the same way as the Freedom of Information Act, was originally trailed in our first manifesto, and for reasons which the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister and now the Minister for Infrastructure and Planning, Paul Rudd, have explained, were not delivered in that original first period in government. They are now being delivered. But I was struck by one of the things that the Honourable Gentleman said, which was the apparent regret on the side of members opposite, representing the last time I checked, the party that I used to know as the Gibraltar Social Democrats, their regret that we had not brought the bill during the lifetime of the first period in government of the GFS Liberals. I remember to speak over lunch, just to amuse myself, I went back and read some of the things that they had said about this policy during the lifetime of the last parliament. And the further former leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, it was, in fact, Sir Peter Cavana, the man that some officers have wanted to describe as the greatest Gibraltarian of all time, for whom all the members threw a lavish party at Grand Battery House, Mr. Speaker, who advised us to include the caveat that the Honourable Member has described about urgency, etc. Should we be foolish enough to progress with the policy of having this particular bill of the Central Book and subjecting government projects to the town planning process? And indeed, this is why we need to criticise Honourable Members opposite and say that when they say we were not transparent and that we had failed to be in the door, we reminded them, not just of the publication of information that we do as a matter of course, which they don't even have to ask us for, which is covered by the Freedom of Information Act, but in particular in respect of town planning. We need to say, you didn't have an open planning process. You held the planning meetings behind closed doors. You didn't even publish the minutes. This is what one is to say, dealing with that issue. And saying that we were reflecting that to them, and that the previous administration meetings would be held behind closed doors and minutes would never get published. But to such charges, there are simple answers. Their spokesman for South Planning said to us during the lifetime of the last parliament, when he tells us that we should have brought this bill, that was the policy of the GOC then, and it remains the policy of the GOC now. What is the speaker? I suppose, in the context of speaking, a unanimous support and conviviality in the passing of legislation, we just gave them a chance to think things through, and a few years later, what was the policy of the GSP then is no longer the policy of the GSP now. They're now allowing themselves with us, and they're working with us for the truth. So, Mr. Speaker, I guess we're all commending the bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think the Chief Minister of the Commission has already eloquently responded to most of the points across the board. I would like to thank members opposite for supporting the bill. It is a very important bill, and it puts right many things that were not addressed before, and issues that the department were facing for a while with procedure, and brings the legislation up to date, which is important. I would like to thank Deputy Chief Minister who left the bill ready back for the first stop at the end. And thank him for the help while he was making responsibility for campaigning and building control. But just to start then, I said, along with going a long way, the Chief Minister has explained how meetings of the BBC were held not held in public. Nowadays, they are held in public. This bill also allows the tribunals to be held in public, which weren't the case also for full transparency in that respect. And I think this bill will not only help applicants, but it will also help the Department of Town Planning and Building Control to continue doing the great work that they do for the government. Thank you.
And now, put a question, which is another bill for an act to revise the law governing planning and development and for collective purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Town Planning Act 2018.
Mr. I would like to give notice that the committee stage and third meeting of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage and third meeting of the bill be taken today.
Committee stage and third reading. The honourable Chief Minister.
I have the honour to move the House to resolve its presence to committee to consider the following bills for all by court. The Tobacco Amendment Act, Bill 2017, the Immigration and Asylum Bill 2018, the Freedom of Information Act 2016, the European Parliamentary Elections Amendment Bill 2018, the Heritage and Antiquities Bill 2018, the Cemetery Bill 2018, the Nature Protection Amendments Bill of 2018, and the schedule of all the pieces relevant thereunder, the Director of Public Prosecutions Bill 2018, the John Matthews World Variation of Stuff Bill 2018, and the Town Planning Bill 2018.
A bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. Clause 1 is amended.
The First Amendment, which the Honourable Members will not see in the marked operation of the bill that was sent, is of course the date, which at the moment reflects 2017 and will need to reflect 2018.
Clause 1 is amended and part of the bill.
And part of the bill. Clause 2 is amended.
The amendment has been circulated in what I shall describe as a rather novel fashion. It is perfectly acceptable if honourable members understand what it amounts to, but I want to make sure that because there is a departure from the more accepted form that honourable members are able to follow what the amendment is. If they are, then there is no problem, and it will then be for the clerk acting on behalf of Parliament to transmit the amended version for publication. So is that clear on members of your position? Are they clear on what?
But it is a departure from the rules, in a sense. So the clause 2, as amended, stands part of the bill. The end title stands part of the bill. The bill for an act to make fresh provision in relation to the immigration and asylum and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 13 stand part of the bill. Clause 14 is amended.
And member has received notification. Clause 14, there is an amendment. Is it agreed to?
Speaker, we are content to have the letter setting out the amendments we haven't even read to this point.
Clause 13 as amended from part of the bill.
Clauses 15 to 61
stand part of the bill.
Clause 62 as amended
stand part of the bill.
Clause 63 to 72. I beg your pardon, clauses 63 to 71
stand part of the bill.
Out of the numbering because it came in late. There's an amendment to 269 over the page.
Turn part of the bill.
Page 69 is amended.
Turn part of the bill.
Page 71.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 72 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 73 and 74.
Stand part of the bill.
The table as amended.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to make provisions for the disclosure of information held by public authorities or by persons providing services to them and for connected purposes. Part 1, Clause 1, as amended,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 2, Clause 3,
stand part of the bill.
Part 2, Clause 4, Clause 11,
stand part of the bill.
Part 2, Clause 12 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 13 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 14 to 16.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 4, Clause 17 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 18 to 22.
Stand part of the bill.
New Clause 23.
Stand part of the bill.
Long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the European Parliamentary Elections Act 2004. Clause 1 to 2.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to make provisions for the conservation, enhancement, and enjoyment of Gibraltar's heritage, antiquities, and objects of archaeological interest, for the preservation of monuments, buildings, historical conservation areas, and archaeological areas, to establish the Heritage and Antiquities Advisory Council, to provide for the management of the Gibraltar National Museum and the Gibraltar National Archives, to provide for the continued existence of the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, and for connected matters. Part 1, Clause 1 to 5,
stand part of the bill.
Part 2, Clause 6 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 7 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 8, 9,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 10 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 3, Clause 11 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 12 to 13.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 14 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 15 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 16 to 18.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 4, Clause 19 to 22.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 5, Clause 23 as amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 24 to 29.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 6, Clause 30.
some part of the bill.
So, 3,100.
Some part of the bill.
$7,342,100.
Some part of the bill.
$32,235.
Some part of the bill.
$36,100.
Some part of the bill.
$37,000.
Some part of the bill.
$38,435.
Some part of the bill.
$39,436,100.
Some part of the bill.
$37,350.
Some part of the bill.
$51,100.
Some part of the bill.
$52,100.
Some part of the bill.
$53,054.
Some part of the bill.
$31,000.
Some part of the bill.
$72,100.
Some part of the bill.
On schedule 2, that's just part 5, the minister gave the notice the Bombay Bristol Burma, and after that the entry alongside east side aircraft referring to the part of the location is now clarifying that by putting off Eastern Beach. I just want to make Mrs. Chairman aware that behind the speaker's chair, I did have a word with the minister. And the minister can confirm that as some heat protection from the government is ready for it, the whole of part 5 needs a bit of clarification on the location, because we are talking about submerged heritage, and although it does pinpoint how deep down it is, we know the amendment is proposed and certified that the east side aircraft is actually off Eastern Beach, but the others one has no idea whether to say on the east side or the west side of the rock. What I'm trying to say is that we have no difficulty in accepting this, but the understanding of the record is that the locations will be actually modified or better pinpointed in future, perhaps the minister can contribute to this one.
I will explain it to the RM before, it will make it mean that the animal is available, so it's not there. This is all being plotted on the GIS, and therefore this will be available in hard copy officially as a formal document in the Minister for Heritage office, and it will also be available in electronic form. So it will be absolutely clear exactly what the limits of all these sites are. And this will be available, I am informed, as soon as the act is coming.
It's a simple thing, Mr. Chairman. It's just a question of someone reading the bill when it becomes out there, unless a specific note of those go to the minister's office to find the location. It's just, one has to rely on something other than commonly relating to know this application. I'm just making an inquiry as to the validity, if one sits in an office and looks at the actual.
It is stipulated, and just having the legal guys who work very, very hard on this and all the other days, so checking the exact location of the very direct. In section 12.2, it says the key shall be in such form as prescribed by the minister and accompanied by such cards as deposited at the offices of the minister with responsibility for heritage. So that will be the formal register, so to speak, of the schedule. And it will be there, available both in hard and in electronic copy. So it is clearly specified that Stafford will do that.
I'm grateful for what has been done.
So we see Schedule 5 is amended,
term part of the bill,
Schedule 6,
term part of the bill,
long term,
term part of the bill.
A bill for an act to provide for the management of control of cemeteries. Schedule 1 to 18,
term part of the bill.
Schedule 1 and 2,
term part of the bill.
Long term,
term part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Nature Protection Act 1991. Schedule 1 to 2.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to establish the Office of Director of Public Prosecutions under the direction of the Attorney General and for connected and for methods connected thereto.
The
long title.
Stand part of the bill.
There is four amended.
Could I speak very today from the Honourable the Minister that Clause 4.1 will read, once amended, that it will read as can you explain exactly how it will read when those amendments are made? 4.1. It won't be the government, will it be the Attorney General, shall in consultation with the governor, appoint a person by note. Michael? Thank you.
Clause 4 amended.
Term part of the bill.
Clause 5.
Term part of the bill.
Clause 6 is amended.
Term part of the bill.
The long term.
Term part of the bill. The amendment of this notice of beginning is to substitute government, take over government, and substitute in its place Attorney General. And therefore, it will read the Attorney General shall, in consultation with the governor, no?
Mr. Chairman is referring to Clause 4. You're referring, I think, to
Clause 4. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman is referring to Clause 4, and therefore he has correctly read the substitution of a.
Amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 5,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 6 is amended,
stand part of the bill.
The long term,
stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to very important provisions contained in the rule of the late John McIntosh.
Clause 1 to 2,
stand part of the bill.
The stadium,
stand part of the bill.
Long title.
Stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to revise the law governing planning and development and for connected purposes.
Part 1, 41 and 2. Stand part of the bill.
Part 2, 43 and 2.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 3, 45 to 14.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 4, clauses 15 to 31.
Stand part of the bill, Mr. Chairman. If I may,
just on paragraph 22. I believe it'll be called 22. Yeah. 22.1a is what I'm referring to. I noticed that there has been a subtle but possibly significant change from the previous act, insofar as it now reads that a certificate stating that the applicant is the sole owner of the land to which the application relates. It used to say is an owner of the land. And I just wonder, from my understanding, why that change was made and what is the effect of that change, because presumably it is possibly the case that there can be multiple owners and how will that impact on their ability to apply.
This refers to applications where there's only one owner, that is the sole owner. So if there's more than one owner, then this would not apply.
In which case it could be meant about pointing to the section that applies to multiple ownership, because I'm not quite clear on where that section would arise.
Mr. Speaker, it's actually 22.1b is when there's multiple owners. So section 22.1a is for when there's only one sole owner, and the following section is section B is when there are more than one owner.
Yeah, I understand that, but in a case where perhaps all the owners are of one mind, in other words, they're always to make an application for an example. A building where there are three owners and they want to put a lift in the building and they wish to apply as one. Paragraph B doesn't really make for that particular provision, so I'm slightly confused. What paragraph B says is that, yes, if a sole owner, or if there are multiple owners, an individual who wishes to make an application must, if you like, notify those other owners. What isn't clear to me is if all the owners, if there are multiple owners, all of the same mind, what process would they follow? Because at the moment, this one applies for a sole owner.
They actually still have to provide, if there's more than one owner, they still have to provide proof that they were in agreement, they wouldn't be accepted. If there's only one sole owner, then the A would be relevant. Otherwise, if there's more than one owner, even if they are commonly believed that they want a listing in a block, they still have to prove that the other owners are party to that application.
So, if I understand it, then one of the owners, because they wouldn't be a sole owner, one of the owners would have to approach, even though they're all of the same mind, would have to approach the other owners in accordance with paragraph C and go through that process. There's no way for them to put in a joint application for the property. Wouldn't it be sensible to have a process for a joint application where owners are of the same mind? It just strikes me as making it more straightforward for everybody involved if you couldn't have a single joint application in those circumstances.
I would assume if there's proof that the state owners are in agreement and there's three signatures on one application, I suppose that's something which can be considered, and I will refer that back to the law drafters. But otherwise, there's no guarantee of that, unless there's three consent, that all three are happy with the application.
And the reason I ask is clearly because the previous legislation didn't have that provision, it just said an owner. And so this change has been made deliberately in this bill. So I assume perhaps that there was some precedent or some reason why that change had been made, and that the experience of the DTP indicated there was value in making the change. But what I'm understanding is that there isn't necessarily any real value, and it's just perhaps hindering a certain sector who may wish to make a joint application.
I'm told that this is because there's been applications before with someone claiming that they are one owner, and so the idea was if you're a sole owner, then there would be no need to seek permission or approval under the deal. But there have been cases, come to the department, hence leading in the need to change or draft this section of the list.
I can understand the need to demonstrate where a fair applicant, if you like, is making that application for a piece of land, or that they need to demonstrate that they are the sole owner, and where they're not the sole owner, and other applicants haven't come forward for the same project, there would clearly be a need on the part of that particular individual to seek the approval of the other owners if they have not come forward. But really, where you have a situation where there are a number of owners all of the same mind and they have all signed, if you like, the application, wouldn't it make sense to have a facility for them just to be able to sign the application rather than have to go through a separate process whereby one of the owners, and I don't know, there could be 16 other owners of the same building, that one of the owners has to approach all of the other owners who are in agreement with them anyway, just to comply with Part B, where the final step forward story of the application itself could be signed by all the owners to say we are of one mind.
Speaker, I've just been told that if it's of help, what can happen? We can say as part of 22.1A, a specific statement that the applicant is the sole owner.
Owner.
We can add an S, and that may be the issue that you're.
That would obviously deal with that issue, so that would make sense, yeah.
We're going to have a small amendment to that. I will require it in writing.
Doesn't make sense. In English, the applicant is cannot be the sole owner. The applicant. The applicant is singular and owner is plural. The amendment would then be that clause 22(1)(a) be amended by substituting for the applicant is the sole owner, the word, the applicant is the sole owner of the A. Is that understood? We take out the word, well, we don't take them out, or we don't take effectively, by taking out the word owner, right, in 22(1)(a), we take by omitting the word owner and substituting therefore the word owner oblique owners. It's like that one of the most business to speak it fully grammatically. It has to be the applicant is/are the sole owner/owner. I think that there is only one applicant. There would be one application made on one single form, and that would be on behalf of owner or owners. Okay, that is then the amendment is not approved. So clause 22(a) 22 as amended stands part of the bill.
So, clauses 23 to 31
stands part of the bill.
Part 5, clauses 32 to 53
stands part of the bill.
Part 6, clauses 54 to 60
stands part of the bill.
Part 7, clauses 61 to 64
stands part of the bill.
Part 8, clauses 65 to 73
stand part of the bill.
Schedule 1 and 2
stand part of the bill.
Schedule 3 as amended
stand part of the bill.
The land title
stand part of the bill.
Let's report the Tobacco Amendment Bill 2017, 18 now, the Immigration and Asylum Bill 2018, the Freedom of Information Bill 2016, the European Parliamentary Elections Amendment Bill 2018, the Terrorism and Antiquities Bill 2018, the Cemeteries Bill 2018, the Nature Protection Amendment Bill 2018, the Director of Public Prosecutions Bill 2018, which are matters of whim, the Will of the Trust Bill 2018,
and the Town Planning Board 2018 have been considered in committee and agreed to, some with and some without amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I want to put the question, which is that the Tobacco Amendment Bill 2017, the Immigration and Asylum Bill 2018, the Freedom of Information Bill 2016, the European Parliamentary Elections Amendment Bill 2018, the Heritage and Antiquities Bill 2018, the Cemeteries Bill 2018, the Nature Protection Amendment Bill 2018, the Director of Public Prosecution Bill 2018, the Game Offensive Bill Variation of Class Bill 2018, and the Town Planning Bill 2018. That these have been agreed to in the, by the Parliament in the claim of now the one that you in the claim of the immigration bill with abstention from the members of the opposition, other than that all members have voted in favour, and therefore these should all be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
It's been a long session. We've dealt with the appropriation, we've dealt with more bills than this House has dealt with for a long time. And the mood inside has not been as hot as the temperature outside, which is always a benefit to vulnerable members' blood pressure. So I now move that the House should adjourn for the long vacation and adjourn to the ideas.
In moving that the House should adjourn to the ideas, I wish to express the hope that all members will have a very peaceful and successful vacation. The House will now adjourn immediately.